All right. As everyone's coming in, we'll go ahead and get started. This is the fifth section in our series on church history, and up to now we've spent the last four lessons really looking at the ancient or patristic church. And beginning over the next two lessons, we're going to spend some time looking at the medieval church. And this is probably the period which, for Protestants, is the most obscure, the most unknown. We typically tend to shut that off. That's not important. That's when the Catholics were around. And between 451 and 1530s, we don't really need to worry about that thousand or so years of history. So I've spent the past four lessons covering 400 years of history. I'm going to spend one lesson covering about 500 years of history. So we're going to be moving at a little bit more of a rapid pace. And the thing that sets the medieval church in motion is the collapse of the Roman Empire. Now, we've spent the last couple of lessons talking about how the Roman Empire is sick. We talked about how the Emperor Diocletian used that as a reason for his persecution of the church. But this process, the Roman Empire is so strong, so well established, so powerful, that really the decline is going to last from about 180 AD. If you want to talk about the decline of the Roman Empire, if you were to read Gibbon's Decline of the Roman Empire, he's going to start with the end of the five good emperors, and he's going to trace that out over the next roughly 400 years. So the decline period is very long. But the problems of the Roman Empire, we'll come back to that one in just a second. So next, yeah. Well, you can go two slides. There it is. The Roman Empire. Here's the Roman Empire at its, well, close to its height anyway. And as time goes on, as the Roman Empire weakens and gets weaker, parts of the Roman Empire begin being lost to Roman control. It shrinks. But this is going to really lead to the characteristics of the medieval church. The problems of the Roman Empire are going to lead to the characteristics of the medieval church. And this is going to be an ambiguous relationship with government. That might seem strange for the medieval church. We typically tend to think of the medieval church and government working very, very closely together. But much of the medieval church period is going to be spent with conflict between the church and the state. Who's going to run the show? How is this relationship going to work? The next part of this is that part of that ambiguous relationship is tied to the rise of the Bishop of Rome. So we really talk about the papacy starting to become important and influential during the medieval time period. That's a very, very long process. And then finally, the characteristics, especially of the early medieval church, but even in the later medieval church, are going to be missionary movements. And this is going to be tied very closely with monasticism. Monasticism is going to be the arm that carries out the missionary movements of the church. And this is going to continue even today with the Catholic Church. And on into the counter time of the Counter-Reformation, the Jesuits are going to be the real missionaries of the church. So we see monasticism as being really the hands and feet, the arms of the medieval church. We can go to the next two slides. Here's Christianity. Towards the end of the Roman Empire, really we're talking about the yellow and the pink and maybe a little bit of the purple are the time periods. By the end of this time period, everything in purple and everything in brown, pink, and yellow is going to be Christianized by this point. So at the beginning of the time period, we're really talking about the pink, and we can see there's a very big spread in the area of Christianization during the medieval period. All right, so what are the problems of the empire? It's going to be the next slide. The internal problems of the empire, I like to tell my kids at school that when we talk about the fall of a civilization, we're really picturing a tree that's rotting from the inside out. And while external problems might in the end be the final thing that brings the tree down, the tree only comes down because it's already weakened on the inside. And this is the problem with the Roman Empire. We have internal problems of succession. So who's going to be the next Roman emperor after the previous Roman Empire emperor dies? This leads to civil wars. Also, the real power to appoint new emperors is in the hands of the military, and that's going to cause a lot of problems, especially as the Roman military becomes more and more barbarian. The Roman Empire emperors are going to use barbarians as a way of filling out their military, and as military becomes more and more in the hands of barbarians, the barbarians are going to gain more and more power. We also have an economic crisis that goes on during this time, rampant inflation, The emperors constantly devalue currency to make more money. So we need more money. So how are we going to do that? We're going to make the money contain less gold, less silver. This leads to the devaluation of currency, and this inflation and the devaluation of currency causes the collapse of trade in a money economy. And so it really moves backwards, where people have been using money and money had been valued. Now people are starting to go back to a bartering system and things like this. This all causes massive amounts of problem within the empire. And then external pressures. External pressures, we have the invasions of the barbarians. And this is going to be one of the really interesting facts that come up during the time of the early part of the Roman Empire, is for really one of the few time periods in history before the modern time period, we really have a period in which people are pretty settled. There's not a lot of people movement that goes on. Now, that really starts to change during this later part of the Roman Empire as people in Central Asia began moving west. That forced the other people that were already there in the lands that they're moving into to move. And this causes these massive migrations of people. It's not a new problem for the Roman Empire. The Roman emperors had been dealing with barbarians trying to enter the Roman Empire since the time of Marcus Aurelius, the last of the five good emperors, in about 180 AD. So it's not a new problem. It's just the Roman Empire was so strong, they could choose to let them in or keep them out as they saw fit. Their armies and their empire was powerful enough to stop the barbarians. But as it weakens, this becomes a problem. And the Roman Empire emperors, to kind of alleviate the pressure, are going to allow certain barbarians to enter. And one of the groups that they allow to enter are the Goths. And then the Goths are mistreated by the people that the Romans put over them, and this causes the Goths to rebel. And the Roman Emperor Valens, the Arian Roman Emperor Valens, is killed at the Battle of Adrianople. We talked about that last week. But the Goths destroy the Roman Emperor and his army. And then the big group of people that we typically hear about during this time period are the Huns, who come from Central Asia, one of the early horse peoples to travel Western Europe, and they are defeated at the Battle of Calonne in Central France. And this is the Romans and the Goths and the Germans all uniting to defeat the Huns so that they won't come into Western Europe. So we have lots of problems. And this is going to lead to the collapse of the Roman Empire. By 476, the last Roman emperor, a child by the name of Romulus Augustus, is going to be deposed by his German military commander, a guy by the name of Odoacer, and he's going to be sent into exile, not killed, thankfully, and that's it. Now, to the people living at the time period, to the everyday person, no one suddenly jumps up and says, hey, I'm now living in medieval Europe. Things have really changed. No one notices that. Life goes on. The things don't really change. It's only going to be a very gradual time period, and the only reason is later historians come back and view this date as the date when the Roman Empire in the West ends. Now, the Roman Empire in the East, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, they're going to be able to throw off their barbarian military commanders. And the Eastern Roman Empire, which later historians will call the Byzantine Empire, is going to last for another 1,000 years. It's not going to be until 1453 that the Turks finally conquer Constantinople and the last remnants of the Roman Empire is destroyed. But that's the title for next week. So, this problem of the collapse of the Roman Empire causes problems for Christianity. Christianity is the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. This is going to cause problems for the church. All right. One of the main things that caused problems for the church is that the empire was kind of the source of the church's authority in society. The emperors gave money to the church. The empires gave part of their power to the church. The emperors appointed bishops as rulers or local magistrates. They gave them some of their power to kind of govern the local areas. Now, that's going to be gone. So the church is going to have to find a new source of power or a new source of authority to be able to govern their people. This also is going to cause the church to rethink its relationship with the world. This is going to be one of the first times in which the church, after the time period of Constantine, is really forced to reexamine what is my role or what is the role of the church in society. And this caused the problem, right? The collapse of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had become Christianized, if you want to use that expression, in the time period after Constantine. The majority of the people were at least nominally Christian. And so this forced Christians to ask questions like, how can the providence of God allow for the collapse of a Christian Roman Empire, especially when the people that are bringing about the collapse of the Roman Empire are pagans, or even worse, they're Arians. Right? So how can a good God allow this to happen? So this is going to force the church to re-examine its relationship with society, with the world, with government. All right. Now, another part that comes into this is the de-Christianization of the West. The West up till this time period had at least become nominally Christian, especially in the cities in the West and the towns in the western part of the Roman Empire, not nearly as much as in the East. But with the invasion of the barbarians, people like the Goths, the Vandals, the Lombards, all are Arians that during the time period of Arianism in the East had been Christianized, or at least by heretical Christians anyway. This is the work of the famous missionary Ulfilas, whose parents were captured by the Goths. He was raised as a slave among the Goths, learned their language, came back to Constantinople, learned Greek, was appointed a bishop, and then went back and Christianized the Goths and also wrote down the Gothic alphabet and translated the Bible into Gothic. But this leads to Arianism. So when these pagans or Arians or barbarians invade the West, not only are they just not Orthodox Christians, but they're hostile to Orthodoxy. So there's going to be renewed periods of persecutions, especially when we get to the Vandals who invade North Africa. They're going to persecute Christians fairly heavily. So it's a renewed round of persecutions. Now, the ones that aren't Arians are going to be pagans. The Franks, the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes are all going to be pagans. And so what ends up happening is the Roman Empire and the areas of the Roman Empire that had been Christian up until this point are now no longer going to be Christian. And this is going to prompt the need for a new missionary movement to kind of go and re-Christianize these areas. So this is a problem that Christianity is going to have to face. Okay. Next slide. All right. So when we're looking at the church's relationship with society, anyway, I'm going to start with this aspect of how the medieval church develops. But really the person that we're going to end up talking about is Augustine of Hippo. Now, he was born in North Africa to Berber parents, probably a fairly low social standing. His mother was a Christian. His father was a pagan. They sacrificed fairly heavily for him to go to school. He's very, very smart, very, very exceptional student. He becomes a teacher of rhetoric, which in the West was the way to be to governmental appointment and things like that. It was like having a law degree almost. That's what you did. You spoke, you wrote. He was a teacher of this. He was a master of it. But he converts to Manichaeism, which is a dualistic kind of Eastern religion that was started by a guy by the name of Mani in the old Persian Empire a couple hundred years before this. And this is really a blending of Zoroastrian and dualistic kind of Eastern religion and Christianity. So Augustine converts to this, but then he eventually, in his time period in Milan, hearing the Bishop Ambrose, which we talked a little bit about last time, he converts to Christianity. Here's a famous picture of Augustine in the garden, and this is where he hears the voice that tells him tolo lege, which means take up and read. Dr. O'Kelly tells a funny story about this, that he says that it's Augustine's mother hiding behind a bush that's calling out to him, saying, tolo lege, tolo, take and read. Then he opens it up, he opens to Romans, and this is where his conversion experience takes place. Now, after his conversion and after his baptism in Milan, he wants to go back to North Africa, and he's going to establish a kind of ascetic, monastic community in North Africa. But on one of his trips to the city, the people of the city force him, at the instigation of their bishop, to remain. They kind of take him captive and force him to be their bishop in waiting. And so he's kind of brought into this. He wants to kind of withdraw from the world, but he's kind of forced into being a bishop. Now, where we're really going to know about Augustine is because of his writings. He's going to be a very, very active writer, and he's going to write against Pelagius, who's a British bishop whose heresy, Pelagianism, says that, you know, humans are able to earn their own salvation. They're not fallen, this type of stuff. His work continues on the Trinity, but his main area of helping as far as medieval Christianity goes is going to be this new understanding of the church and this relationship to the world. And this is going to be in this book, The City of God. There you go. The City of God. And what he's going to do in this book that takes him 13 years to write is this is really going to be a massive book. It is massive. that deals with not just with Roman history and Roman religion and heresies and different things like this, but it's also going to deal with this new relationship that has to develop between the church and the state. He's writing, and the background of his writing is the sack of the Rome in 410 by Alaric the Goth. This is the first time in almost 1,000 years that Rome had been sacked. The last time was in 386 B.C. by the Gauls. So it had been a while. So in the background of this, Augustine's having to reassure the people that he's writing to, and the Western world is really his audience here, the Western Roman Empire, that this doesn't change things. Because what he's arguing in his book is that the church and the state are not one and the same thing. These are these two cities, right? There's the city of the world and there's the city of God. And that the physical, right, the physical city that we can all be part of is good in some ways as it's influenced by Christianity, but our ultimate citizenship is not here. So this really, one, helps Christians distance themselves from the downfall of the Roman Empire that's going on, because our ultimate citizenship isn't here. This is not where my ultimate sense of security and well-being and salvation needs to come from. And at the same time, it gives them a positive view of the barbarians who are coming in and invading. If we Christianize them, if we influence them with Christianity, then they can be almost a new Roman Empire. We can change society for the better. All right, so this is kind of his new view. Now, one of the reasons why Pelagianism was so dangerous to Augustine's view is Pelagianism really was a kind of a stating of a Donatist tradition. The pure church, that's what Pelagius is concerned with. The pure church is only those who are able to do right. And Augustine says, no, the church is a mixture of wolves and sheep, wheat and tares. And so this is why one of the reasons why Augustine and Pelagianism, or Augustine's view of salvation and Pelagius' view of salvation, were so diametrically opposed. Next thing that comes up in the medieval church is the rise of the papacy. Now, this is going to take a number of steps, and a lot of times we just think, I think as Protestants, that the medieval period happens and there's the Pope, and he looks just like the popes always did when we get to the time of Martin Luther. And that's not the case at all. The papacy is, at varying times, especially during the Middle Ages, powerful and not powerful. And that really has a lot more to do with the person that's sitting on the throne a lot of times and the circumstances that he finds himself in than it does with just the office in and of itself. So this is what's going to happen with the papacy during this time. And this is where the foundation of papal authority really comes from a medieval perspective anyway. It's from the founding role of the apostles. So only Rome was a see that could claim foundation by not just one, but two apostles, and the big two. They had Peter and Paul. All right? The Roman church was one of the wealthier churches. It was also, for a long time, in the same city as the center of imperial government. So that tends to add a lot of weight to it. And we talked about this last week. The Roman see has a very strong tradition of orthodoxy. So in all the Christological heresies that are going on, from Arianism to, you know, Apollinarianism to, you know, Pelagianism to both Nestorianism and to Monophysitism, the Roman See, all, and the Pope, seems to always come down on the side of orthodoxy. When he writes, eventually, his view of orthodoxy, even if it's not immediately recognized as orthodox, tends to be where orthodoxy falls. So that adds a lot of weight to what he says. All right, and then a history of early bishops of Rome acting as leaders in the West. So from the very beginning of church history, we have the bishops of Rome, people like Clement, writing to Corinth to help them solve problems. And this would have been something that the bishops in the West did. They would write to the bishop of Rome because they didn't really have anyone else to write to in the West. That was the only person there in a big city that they could really write to. They might have had a little bit of learning or something like this. So everyone in the West, if you were a bishop and you had a problem, you would go to Rome, see what he thought. Now, that doesn't mean that the Roman bishops were beyond, right, having problems. So Tertullian and Irenaeus and a number of other people criticized Roman bishops very, very, very sternly. So when one of the Roman bishops excommunicates the people in the East because of their dating of the Easter, Irenaeus says, whoa now, Polycarp celebrated it like this. like they did in the East, we should probably be okay with it. But that's kind of what, but this is kind of what ends up happening. So there's two early popes that I want us to be familiar with. And these are going to be the two who really set the medieval papacy in motion. And the first of these is going to be a guy by the name of Damasus. Pope Damasus the First, his papacy lasts from about 366 until 384. So before a lot of the bad things in the Roman Empire happens, but he's the first guy who makes Matthew 16:18 really central to his authority. People have used it before, but he's the guy who really makes it the foundation of what he's doing. Now, part of the reason that Damasus is so trying to find anything to latch onto to gain himself power is because of the way in which he's elected. During his election, this is during a lot of the Arian controversy that's going on in the West. He's elected. A rival pope is elected at the same time. Riots break out in Rome. 137 people are killed in the streets during this riot. The Roman emperor is forced to come in and choose between the two. He chooses Damasus instead of the other guy. And so Damasus is really in a weak position. At least half the people in the city don't want him and are pretty adamant about not wanting him. So he's really trying to latch on to anything to give himself authority, and he latches on to a lot. But once this all this power and all these claims are kind of made, it's really hard for later popes to say, nah, that power, I don't want that. I'm just fine with what we had before. That's not what happens. So he's going to claim the authority of councils weren't based on the councils themselves, but they're based that the pope approved them. Yeah. Not a good situation, but you have to look at the situation that he's in. When you have multiple councils that are contradicting each other. So you have Nicaea, then you have another council that overturns Nicaea, and then you have Ephesus, you have another council that overturns Ephesus. How do we know which council is authoritative? So the pope says in the West that it's because the pope said that this one was orthodox. That's what gives it authority. So you can understand, even if you don't agree, why this claim was made. Now, he also claims the full authority of Peter as his successor. So when I speak, he's not going to be as blatant as this is the next guy who we're going to talk about. But when I speak, it's basically like Peter speaking. So pay attention. Now, he also wrote in the style of the imperial court. So he started modeling his responses to bishops. He started treating bishops in various parts of the West as if they were provincial governors that he had the ability to direct and control. And he also sought to enforce a higher degree of religious conformity. And this would really have been in regards to things like the age of ordination. So we need to have a set age when people can be ordained to certain areas of ministry, when you can be a deacon, when you can be a presbyter, when you can be a bishop. Also for things like celebrating certain festivals, also for things like celibacy. Celibacy starts cropping up at this time as something that they're seeking to try and enforce. Anyway, and then this leads us to the next pope. The next pope, Leo the Great, or Leo the First, is going to be about 80 years after Damasus. Now, Leo is going to be important because not only is he going to make all the claims that Damasus does, but he's also going to start assuming political control of the city. In the absence of the Roman emperor, by this point, the Roman emperor had moved the capital, even of the Western Roman Empire, from Rome, which was hard to defend, either to Milan or to Ravenna in Italy. And so as the emperor leaves, really the control of the city goes to the pope, the bishop. And this is going to be because of the amount of money and the amount of land and the amount of power that he would have had over the church and over the structure of the government. He's really the guy who's going to be there. So he's going to assume control of the city and the surrounding area. And he's going to be famous for when the Huns come, when Attila comes, he's going to go outside the city, meet him, pay him off so he doesn't sack Rome. Later, when the Vandals come and attack Rome, he's going to try and do the same thing again. Now, it doesn't work quite as well. He doesn't get them not to sack Rome, but he does get them to agree not to kill anyone. So they come in, spend a week stripping the city of everything valuable, carrying off a couple thousand slaves, and then they leave. As far as sacking of a city goes, that's not too bad. So he's also going to restore, in the midst of all these barbarian invasions that are going on, he's really going to work with the Roman emperor to restore the Roman see's authority over various Western bishops. So he's going to maintain kind of that power that he exercises over Western bishops. He's going to defend Christological orthodoxy. He's the guy who's famous for writing the tome that really becomes kind of the Chalcedonian standard for the natures of Christ. And he's going to reaffirm the authority of the Pope is the successor of Peter, and he's going to be the guy who really believes. When I speak, it's no different than Peter speaking. Or at least that's how you should take it. So this is going to be a problem. Now, this is going to lead to a decline in the papacy eventually. Now, the reason for this is that the reason why the popes, one of the reasons politically why the popes were able to gain power is the absence of an emperor. Kind of another pole that power could kind of run to. They were kind of operating in a vacuum. So operating in this vacuum, they just kind of assume the power that's there for them to assume for the betterment of the society around them. Not necessarily a bad thing. So, but there's going to be a period in the West anyway of about 100 years where the West is really free from imperial control. And this is where the popes are going to seize a lot of their power. Now, this is also going to apply to the Eastern Church as well, because there's going to be a theological schism that happens between the East and the West. It's going to last for about 30 years. And this is over once again after the Council of Chalcedon. The East comes up with this kind of new kind of way of looking at the natures of Christ. The Pope's going to then say, that doesn't work. We're not doing that. And so this is going to lead to a schism. And in that schism, the Pope's really going to even assume more authority, because he has no one, not even religiously now, that's really a counterbalance to his power. All right? And Pope Galatius I is going to say that, you know, even the emperor should submit to the Pope, at least in theological matters. So this is going to be even further staking out papal claims to authority. But with the rise of Justinian in the early 6th century, Justinian is really going to be the greatest of the Byzantine emperors, and he's going to conquer much of the West. So if you look at this, you see the Byzantine area is the area over here that's kind of lighter. The darker area is going to be the area that Byzantine conquers. So he's going to conquer, once again, all of North Africa, where the Arian Vandals had kind of upset Roman society. He's going to conquer all that, bring that back under Orthodox Christianity. He's going to conquer all of Italy and parts of Spain. Now, he's going to be a very, very important guy. But what ends up happening in doing this is that Rome really becomes isolated from the rest of Western Europe. So the rest of Western Europe, north of the Alps, is going to be really under barbarian control, but Rome is going to be under Byzantine control. And it's going to be under Byzantine control for the remainder of Justinian's rather long reign of almost 40 years. For about a 40-year period, Rome is going to really lose its position as the leader in the West, and because it's under Byzantine control. Number of popes are going to be Greeks. They're going to have to conform to what Justinian wants theologically. And their eyes are really not going to be turned west, but they're going to be turned back east. And so this is going to lead to the Roman papacy really losing power. And it's not really going to regain that power for about 100 years afterwards. Until Justinian's off the throne, and then we get a Roman pope who reasserts his power. All right. So what's going to happen now in the West is that we're going to have to re-Christianize it. We talked about this, and this is the other area. If you probably think of two things religiously about the Middle Ages, you think about the Pope and you think about monks. And that's probably what you think about. So we've kind of talked about the early history of the popes. We'll talk about them again as they grow in power. And then next week, we're going to talk about them a lot as we talk about really what we think of as the height of the medieval papacy, with the investiture controversies and the conflicts with the emperors of Germany and different things like this. But we're going to talk about at least the beginnings of monasticism right now. And so monasticism in the West has Eastern origins. It comes from the East. You have people like Basil of Caesarea and John Cassian. John Cassian is in Egypt, and then he comes to the West. He establishes a monastery outside the modern French city of Marseille. And he's going to bring monasticism there. Now, monasticism isn't just Eastern people that might move to the West, but it's also people in the West. So we have native Western people like Martin of Tours is going to be very influential, Patrick of Ireland, and then most famously Benedict of Nursia. All right, next slide. All right, now there are two forms of monasticism. We went over this last week, but we'll review very quickly. There's an isolated hermits. That doesn't really pick up a whole lot in the West, although some of the Irish kind of carry along this little bit of isolation. But because of the climate in the West, opposed to the climate in the East, the West is going to be much more conducive to these communities, which is the next slide we think of. And this is really modeled by Pachymus and other people in Egypt who form communities of monks that work together. Hard work, strict discipline, Hachimus was a former soldier. So is Martin of Tours, who founds one of the first monasteries in the West in central France. He's a soldier too. And so this is going to be kind of this rigid, disciplined organization. All right. Now, Benedict of Nursia, and when we talk about monasticism, especially in the early part of the Middle Ages, we're really talking about Benedictine monasticism. And that's really not going to end until about the 11th or 12th century when we really get a proliferation of monastic orders. Up until that time, if you were a monk, most likely a Benedictine monk. Now, he would have been familiar with the writers of John Cassian, and another person that's just we know as just the master. So these two guys that would have written rules before Benedict. Now, Benedict is famous for founding the monastery at Monte Cassino. Here's a picture of it. Now, this is a rebuilt monastery because the Allies during World War II shelled it and destroyed it because they thought that the Germans had stored weapons and ammunition in it, which they hadn't. One of the few good things they probably, nice things that they did anyway. Now, he is going to write a rule for the governance of his monastery and other monasteries that are going to look to Monte Cassino as an example. And the thing that sets his rule apart, and here's, if we want to go to the next rule, here it is. These are the three characteristics of his rule: poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, this wouldn't have not been anything new as far as monasticism goes. You can't own individual properties. You can't be married. You have to be obedient to the head of the monastery. And it's really this obedience thing that really is the emphasis of Benedict's rule. He talks about it over and over again. But the really interesting thing is the kind of the care that he takes for the humanness of the people who are going to be part of his society. So, you know, when you have to wake up in the middle of the night and go to say prayers, you're supposed to say the first prayer very slowly so that the people who are a little bit late in rising have the chance to get there before it's over and be embarrassed. So these kind of things. He's going to be very just kind of, you know, you're supposed to work, you're supposed to do this, but he's going to leave it open to interpretation. And this is going to be one of the great things about the Benedictine rule, and one of the reasons why the Benedictine rule is still, you know, if you're going to look at a monastic rule that governs monasticism, it's this. This is what it is. It's because of its just kind of taking into account the human nature of the people that are going to be part of it. Now, what did the monks do? There's purposes of monasticism. There are two sides to this, I really think. There are personal sides to the monks doing things, and there are societal things that the monks did. Now, personally, there's salvation. They're seeking to earn their salvation, kind of to work out their salvation. They do this by seeking to be pure, seeking to flee from the world, seeking to flee and exist in this community of pure Christians that they're going to surround themselves with. Now, societally, this is going to be one reason why monasticism becomes so prevalent in the West, is because it really fulfills a number of social needs. One of these is the monks are really viewed as these spiritual soldiers who are going to go out into the countryside and cleanse the land of paganism. So they're going to go out, they are the foot soldiers of Christ that are going to go out into the land and cleanse the land of paganism. They are. They're going to serve an educational need. Monasteries are going to be the only source, basically, of education. They're going to preserve Western culture, Western literature. So you have people like Cassiodorus in Italy, who's not just going to make beautiful copies of the scriptures, but he's also going to make beautiful copies of Virgil and Aristotle and Plato and preserve a lot of Western literature that might have been destroyed otherwise in the barbarian invasions. Now, one of the other things that it solved was this penitential type of thing. Now, we would disagree with this, but I just want to let you know that this is how they viewed it, right? One of the things that happened in the church at this time, and we'll talk about this later as we get into medieval society a little bit more next week, but one of the things that happened when you sinned was you were given penance to do. Now, for the medieval, it didn't matter if I did the penance or someone else did the penance that I paid them to do. We're going to get into a lot of trouble with this later, and it has a thing, but this is what it did. So they would pay monks to say their penance for them. And so, really what they had, and this happened in the what was called the divine office, so seven times a day, the monks would meet and worship. And in a week, they would sing through the Psalms. In a year, they would read through all the Bible. They would wake up in the middle of the night and do this. But it's through this divine office that they're really doing this penance. And so they're really, in a lot of ways, they viewed it anyway, and this is how people viewed it, whether it's true or not, is that they viewed it that they were earning the salvation of the people around them. They were this holy group of men who were really working out salvation for the community at large. And that made this the founding of these communities very, very appealing. And working in these communities, very, very appealing. It was a job. It was a necessary way that society had to function. Another thing that it did was it filled family type of things. So, at no point in Western society has there been enough resources, land, money for all the children that nobles had. And so what do you do with these excess children, especially girls? You got to find something for them to do. Well, look at this. This is a great noble kind of task that we can do. And people like Patrick, when he goes to Ireland, is really going to use this, right? The Druid society that people had been a part of before this is going to talk about, you know, dedicating children to the Druids, whether they were sacrificed or not. There's some talk about that. But Patrick would say, no, you give those children to the church now. And they became monks and nuns. So this is going to be a part of society as well. Now, these are the problems to this. Right? Personally, it kind of led this kind of rigidness and corporate worship aspect of Benedictine life led to kind of a spiritual malaise. They kind of wanted a person, more of a personal relationship than they were able to have. Now, all right, the penitential problems, we talked about this, but it really led to two classes of Christians. You had people that were monks and clergy, and you had everyone else, and they weren't the same. One was better than the other. If you really wanted to know that you were saved, you went and became a monk. All right? Now, there's social and economic struggles that the monasteries faced as Western Europe becomes more and more settled. As time goes on, there's less and less land to devote to these big monasteries. So that led to them struggling economically, and that led to them restricting their membership. So the membership in Benedictine monks went down and down and down as the amount of money that the monasteries could make off their land went down and down as well. Now, one of the most important things that these monks are going to do, if we go to the next slide, is going to be the Christianization of Europe. Now, here we have all the barbarians that invade the Roman Empire. We have Angles, Saxons, and Jutes going to Britain. We have Franks coming into northern France. We have Vandals. They led a long journey from central Germany down into the Balkans, over into France, down into Spain, and then down into North Africa. And then up into, they invaded Rome and Greece and a number of other places. And then we had the Goths, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths. That just means the East and the West Goths. So you have the Ostrogoths, which are the East Goths that end up settling in Italy. And you have the Visigoths, which end up settling in Spain. And then you have another group of people that come in later called the Lombards that are going to settle in Italy as well. So you have all these barbarians who are conquering the Roman Empire and filling up the places where the Romans had been before. And this is going to lead to a lot of missionary movements. And so the re-Christianization of Europe, we're going to talk about this as three examples of this. The Irish, the Franks, the British, and the Germans. The Irish are obviously Christianized by Patrick. This is going to even be before, really, the final collapse of the Roman Empire. Patrick's mission to Ireland is going to take place in about 433. He's not the first missionary to Ireland. But he is going to go to the northern and western sections of Ireland. But his way that I talked about earlier about him linking monasticism with the noble families of Ireland really helps them invest in Christianity. And it really leads to this long, rich kind of ownership of Christianity by the Irish, and especially by the people, the chieftains, who would have been in charge of Irish society. And this movement is going to be very, very, very potent. And missionary movements from Ireland are going to go back to Britain and Scotland and to France from Ireland after they Christianized Ireland. And then when the barbarians invade and kind of overwhelm those areas and Christianity kind of falls away, the Irish are going to go back into the areas that Christianized them and Christianized those areas. Right? In Gaul, we have the Franks. The Franks are really the only barbarian people who last in the Western Roman Empire. Out of all the people that invade the Western Roman Empire, the Franks are really the only ones that stick around. So the Franks are going to be very important, and it's going to be very important that they're not Arians, and that in 496, their king, Clovis, or Clodovicus, is Christianized. And it's going to be important His wife is going to be important in this. Her name was Clotilda. She's a Christian. She was a Burgundian who was married off to this pagan Frankish king. And she was very influential in talking to him about her faith, trying to get him to convert, telling him the values of it. She actually baptized her children against his will. One of them died. He was mad because it was the baptism that had killed it. The same thing happened to the next one. She baptized it again against his will. It almost died, but didn't. And then in a battle, not unlike the famous story of Constantine, in a battle that he's losing, he calls on the God of his wife and the God of St. Martin of Tours, and he wins the battle. And this is really the impetus for him converting to Christianity. Now, it's going to be a long road for the Franks. And the Franks are going to have a number of struggles as they politically have some problems, and the king and politics and religion get all mixed up. But the Franks are going to be one of the reasons why Christianity really sticks around in Europe, because the Franks are going to eventually go out and conquer everyone else. And so since they're Christian, they're going to push the Arian Vandals and Visigoths out. They're going to go out and conquer the pagan Saxons and central Germans, and they're going to bring their Christianity with them when they do this. That's going to be very important. Now, in Britain, it's early Christianized by the 3rd and 4th century. So by the 300s and 400s, we have evidence of Christianity already being in Britain. But about this time period, too, the Romans leave Britain and go back. We can't defend it any longer. We're going to pull our troops back to France. And this leads eventually to the Picts and the Scots in the north invading. And the British call in, hey, Angles, Saxon, Jutes, why don't you come over here and help us fight the Picts? Well, the Angles, Saxon, and Jutes come over and say, this land looks nice. Why are we protecting you when we could just run the place? So they kind of conquer. And the Britons are really pushed back. The original Britons are really pushed back into what later becomes Cornwall and Wales. Now, these people are eventually going to be re-Christianized in the north by the Irish and in the south by Roman missionaries that are going to be sent by the Pope Gregory the Great. Now, Gregory is going to be this pope who comes around after Rome has kind of separated itself now from the Byzantines again. And one of the first things he does is he's going to look to the west and see, where can I start establishing connections? Rome and where? And there's this Ethelbert, the king of Kent, which is this little yellow section down here in the south, has a Christian wife named Bertha. So he's like, hey, I got a road in right there. And so what he does is he sends a group of Benedictine monks under Augustine, a guy by the name of Augustine, and we separate himself from Augustine of Hippo. This is Augustine of Canterbury. And he's going to go and Christianize southern England. And he's going to establish his see at the Kentish capital of Canterbury. And it's going to be the see of the English church forever after. So Christianization comes to Britain. Now, as English Christianity spreads, this blending of Celtic and Roman Christianity in England is really going to be something special. And it's going to just lead to England being really for a long time the intellectual and kind of cultural center of Europe. And one of the aspects of this kind of cultural blossoming that goes on in England at this time is that England Christianity is going to go out and spread to new areas. It goes out and spreads to Holland. So we have missions to the Frisians in the late 600s and early 700s. And then most importantly, we have the life of Winfrid or Boniface, who's going to be the apostle of Germany. And he's going to be born in England, southern England. He's going to be educated there. He's very, very bright. He turns down the post of an abbot as of his monastery because he wants to be a missionary to the Frisians. He goes to Frisia. He's not successful. He comes back to England and then goes to Rome, where the Pope makes him a missionary to the Germans. And he goes, and using his connections back with England, he's able to draw a number of English monks to Germany to help him. And he goes about, especially Western Germany, Christianizing up and down, planting monasteries. And eventually, he's going to become the papal legate. He's going to be very influential in tying the papacy, who he's a messenger for. His authority comes from the Pope. The Pope is the one who's commissioned him to kind of go out and do this. He's going to be very influential in linking the papacy and a new power that's rising in the Franks, the Carolingians. So this new power, this rise of the Carolingians, he's going to be very influential in linking them together. It's going to be very, very important later on. He's going to reform the French church. And eventually, He's going to go back to Frisia when he's about 75 years old, and he's going to be martyred there as he's waiting to baptize some recent converts. He's going to be attacked by a group of barbarians and killed in about 75. Now, the rise of the Carolingians is going to be very, very important. The old French dynasty called the Merovingians, the descendants of Clovis, have kind of lost a lot of their power. And the power in France really resides in the commanders of the army, who are called the mayors of the palace. And in 732, Muslims, which we'll talk about as we go on a little bit longer, Muslims had spread to Spain and now were invading France. The mayor of the palace of the Franks fight a battle at the Battle of Tours, which is right here. His name is Charles the Hammer, and defeat them, invading Muslims. One of the most important battles in all of Western civilization. And this is the guy who Boniface is going to be very closely working with. Him and his son, a guy by the name of Carloman. And Carloman has a brother, Pepin, who we'll talk about in a second. But Carloman is very, very religious. And he's the guy that Boniface really works with to reform the French church. Carloman ends up stepping down as the mayor of the palace and ends up being a monk himself. So he's very, very religious. Now, his brother, Pepin, has a little bit of a cooler relationship with Boniface, but Pepin is going to be very influential. This relationship that's been established with the Pope. The Pope knows he has at least some connection with this guy. The Lombards, another group of barbarians, have invaded Italy and are threatening Rome. The Pope says, Pippin, can you come down here and help me? Pippin does. Pippin, in exchange, says, you know, I'm not the king, but I sure would like to be. So the Pope says, sure, we can work that out for you. And so the last of the Merovingian kings, his hair is cut, which was the symbol of royal power. His hair is cut and he's shipped off to a monastery. Now, Pippin's son is going to be Charlemagne, the greatest king in the medieval time period. And he's going to have an even more interesting relationship with the Pope. Now, the Pope at the time is a guy by the name of Leo III. Leo III is a commoner. The Roman nobility who really controlled the papacy at this time aren't very big fans of that. They try and gouge out his eyes and cut out his tongue. Nice. And he escapes and flees to Charlemagne. Charlemagne says, well, we can't have this. So he goes back. He reinstalls Leo. He deals with all the Roman nobility who are causing problems. And on Christmas Day in 800 AD, the Pope places the old Roman imperial crown on his head, and we have a new Roman Empire that later is called the Holy Roman Empire, and this is going to last for about the next 1,000 years until Napoleon gets rid of it. Now, this is going to create a new relationship between church and state. So where the Pope had kind of been in this vacuum of power, now the Pope has set up kind of a rival to himself in power, and the emperor is going to be very quickly to seize upon that. Charlemagne wasn't probably particularly pleased with being crowned by the Pope. He's happy to be the Roman emperor, but wasn't probably pleased that the Pope is the one that he felt could give him that authority. So the church is going to be at the mercy of the states for two reasons. And one is the weakness of the Pope. The Pope are going to be surrounded by enemies and by friends who a lot of times are going to function like enemies. So the Pope's not going to have a lot of authority. And what authority the Pope could have is going to be the king's. During this time period, the kings are going to be the ones that have the power to appoint bishops in their land because the bishops are going to be royal servants. They're going to be the guys that are the counselors of the king. They're going to be the guys that they're going to put in charge of land because guess what happens to land that a bishop has? When he dies, he has no kids, so it comes back to the king. So the king gains control. If he gave it to a noble, the nobleman's going to have kids and the nobleman's kids are going to get it, and he loses control of that land, which is what had happened to the Merovingians. So Charlemagne is going to be much smarter about this, and this is going to be one big reason why Charlemagne is really, really, really going to push celibacy for the priests, is because he's concerned about his land staying in his power and being able to appoint that. Now, the popes are going to have the ability to kind of ratify archbishops that are appointed, but that's about it. They don't really get a lot of say, and it's only when the kings get weak enough that the popes are going to really start pushing that, no, this power belongs to us. But that's not going to come around for a while. Next one. Go to the next slide. Yeah, okay. Is that the next slide? All right, well, if that's the next slide, that's the next slide. Well, this is going to lead to a lot of problems between the church and state. We talked about a couple of these. The problems between the church and state are going to be theological. compromises that the church is going to have to make by being part of and being tied in with the state. Right? There are going to be theological compromises. Celibacy. The church is going to have to kind of accept this. Also, Charlemagne is going to be instrumental in inserting the filioque clause into the Nicene Creed. He's going to push this because he's still dealing with Arianism. And he wants to make sure that the Son is equal to the Father, and so that the Spirit proceeds not just from the Father, but from the Father and the Son. And that's what that means in Latin. Filioque is "and the Son." So there's going to be a number of theological compromises that take place. And the Bishop of Rome, Leo III, when he writes up the Nicene Creed and puts it in Rome at this time period, it doesn't have the filioque on it. So there's some tension still there, but Charlemagne is going to be the one who wins out because he's the one with the power. Now, what ends up happening after the time of Charlemagne is, according to Frankish or Salic law, Charlemagne's kingdom is divided between his sons. All of his sons get an equal share of the kingdom, and this leads to the empire being divided. And none of his... You can always tell about a king by what kind of name people give him afterwards. Charles is called the Great. His sons are called the German and the Bald. His grandson's called the Fat. So, not necessarily what you're really looking for in a line of successors. You know, what's the best way? Yeah, he was bald. No, he was German. He was fat. I don't know. So I guess that's better than awful. Or someone's that we'll talk, you know, you could have been the King of England, Ethelred the Unread. So his name meant the wise, the unwise. So they made a pun off of his name. So it could be worse. But what's going to end up happening is the empire that Charlemagne takes all this time to kind of forge and bring together is going to start falling apart. And one of the reasons why it's going to fall apart is we have a new round of barbarian invasions that go on. So just when you think that all the barbarians have been Christianized again and everything's good, we have a whole other set. And this is when you have the Vikings and the Magyars, which come from Hungary, what would be Hungary now, are going to sweep all across Europe and cause a lot of disruption. And this is going to lead to the breakup of the empire. And we're going to go through... This is really, if you want to pick out a period where really you think about time being really bad, right? Leading up to this time period, we typically talk about the time period we've just covered as being the Dark Ages. It really, not that bad, not that much different than late antiquity. This time is where things get bad. And when the empire falls, that's going to create a vacuum, and the popes are going to step right into that vacuum of power caused by the collapse of the empire, and they're going to start grabbing power. I mean, it's not a bad thing, right? This power, someone has to wield this power. Someone has to try and hold Western civilization together as it's falling apart, and the popes are going to be the ones to do it. So we should be thanking them in a lot of ways, but all this power that they kind of grab and bring to themselves is going to cause problems later on. And one of the things I want you to understand next week especially is that as the popes seize power, even in the seizing of the power, they're bringing about their own downfall. So everything that they're doing to gain power and to win these victories over the empire and kind of subjugate the West to themselves, inside of all that, the tactics that they're using, the methods that they're using, that's going to be used against them in the end to bring about their own downfall. All right, any questions about early medieval Christianity? All right. Well, I'll pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank you that long ago, men worked and thought and did your will, and that our ancestors, however long ago for most of us, were at some point Christianized and brought to know you by the work of men who loved you and cared deeply about doing your work and your will in the world. We thank you for their efforts, and we pray that we may, in some way, even if where we disagree with them on certain issues, understand them and respect them for the work that they did. And it's in your name we pray. Amen.